Welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is fabled New York Times journalist Thomas Byrne Edsel. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. Now, we're going to get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. And please check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Brand, Real Paper, and ZBiotics, and our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. James Carville, there was a blue wave that washed over politics America on Election Day this week. Democrats won the governorship in deep red Kentucky. They ended Virginia Governor Glenn Youngkin's presidential hopes by not only rebuffing his massive effort to win control of the state Senate, Democrats kept it, but they even took control of the GOP-controlled previously state house. Abortion rights was a huge winner in Virginia and in Kentucky, where it was deeply joined, and most of all, an overwhelming referendum victory in Ohio, which the GOP unsuccessfully sought to sandbag. Now, to be sure, there were a few defeats. As you know, the one that hurt me and you, I know, was Mississippi, where Democrat Brandon Presley ran a good race against a corrupt Republican administration, but just fell a little short. Mississippi is just too red right now. Democrats lost the Suffolk County executive race, and maybe one or two others, but there were many more Democratic victories. Supreme Court race in Pennsylvania, rejecting right-wing teachers, the Moms for Liberty, not right-wing teachers, but the kind of anti-teachers and school boards, and even Texas noted a big raise for teachers. The Democrats are alive and well. This continues a win streak this year. That's different than President Biden's standing, which I'm sure we'll get to later. James, your thoughts?
Well, we'll start with Virginia. I mean, I work like a rented mule this cycle in Virginia, and obviously Mississippi, Kentucky also. In Virginia, nobody can find Glenn Youngkin. I think I know where he is. He's at the courthouse, the one in Appomattox. And he's waiting to see if General Grant's going to let him keep his mount and his sword.
And does he get to keep his sword?
Yeah. The big hero, the unsung hero of the Virginia cycle is one United States Senator Mark Warner. I mean, when Youngkin was out there with his billionaire friends, Senator Warner went right to work. I'd say he would be the big hero. Of course, my hero in all Virginia politics is our party chair, Susan Swecker, who's been on this show, who did just an outstanding job of state parties matter again, all right? Recruiting and raising money, that matters. So the Virginia stuff was really good news. You know, I think it was last week, we talked about Andy Beshear's campaign manager, Eric Heyer. People just don't have any idea of what a talented politician Andy Beshear is. And he won by five. He won like Letcher County, which is, I never thought a Democrat would ever carry. This guy is a stunningly good politician. And he's somebody that people better keep an eye on. The Ohio thing, all right? Understand, it's the same thing in Kansas. They lie, they cheat, they connive, they try to fool people, they try to confuse the wording, they try to adjust the election day, and every time they get their ass handed to them. What's his name, Frank LaRose, or whoever the Secretary of State there? He's an immoral man. All he does is freaking lie. And I don't know why they think that people, it's not going to irritate or aggravate people. And by the way, if you look at the turnout, the shit the Democrats turned out like crazy in Ohio. The exit polls, Biden would have carried Ohio if just the people had voted in this referendum would have voted. So the Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Mississippi, you got to ask yourself, maybe, you know, Brandon, you know, had a pro-life record. He said he was. But we didn't do that well in Lafayette County, which is Oxford. And I think the trend of low black turnout is going to continue. And there's a Democratic wave everywhere but the Gulf South. There's not much evidence of a big Democratic wave there. But I don't know if that Brandon ran a really good campaign. It raised a lot of money. It's the ones you lose you tend to remember more than the other ones. And I'm going to Ohio, I'm going to Cleveland, actually. I sent the Browns people calling. We'll go up there and do some campaigning with him in January. So they should be pretty organized up there. But yes, it was. And I think we picked up a state legislative seat in New Jersey or something. I mean, it's we just don't lose a
couple. You know, and the GOP thought they were going to take control of one of the House. They not only didn't, but they actually slipped some.
Oh, it was that. Was that close. Oh, okay. I tell you, Governor Murphy, he's a DGA chair. He put some real money in there. This guy's he's no slacker either.
Yeah, no, the DGA did, even in Mississippi, they did a great job. You know, and I have a bias. I can confess it now since we're going to analyze it. My son worked for Brandon Presley down there. I think did a heck of a job. Presley ran a good campaign, James. He actually raised more money than the incumbent, albeit crooked, governor. And he had I was down there for a debate last week, and Presley won decisively. But it may be partially the black vote. I haven't looked at the particulars yet. And it may be it's just an awful tough state to win in. But in any That's event, it. I want to turn to one thing you said that I think I slightly disagree with. And that is that Biden would have carried Ohio with this kind of turnout.
Just so you know, that's not what I said. People that turned out to vote in this referendum, if that would have been the electorate, Biden, it was so pro-democratic. Actually, in the exit poll, Biden beat Trump, the people that voted.
Yeah. I stand corrected. But also, that exit poll showed 73% of the people who voted think Biden is too old. He has a 59-39 negative among what certainly is a more friendly electorate than he's likely to face in 2024. I think that Republicans, as you say, they lie, they play games. It backfired. They even carried some conservative counties, they being the pro-choice side, like Jefferson. But James, when we talk about abortion, yes, Ohio was number one, but Andy Beshear was pro-choice. His opponent was anti-choice. In Virginia, I live in Washington. There was wall-to-wall advertising. Almost every Republican ad talked about crime and talked about Democrats will set loose criminals on the street. And most of the Democratic ads talked about a woman's right to choose. And I went out there and covered one race out in suburban Washington, and a former CIA agent named Russet Perry won rather handsomely against a very wealthy Republican who tried to paint her as soft on crime. It's a problem when you paint someone as soft on crime when they're a former CIA operative and a special prosecutor. She won by more than 5 points. So I think it was just a big win for abortion rights. And let me see just one more thing. Glenn Youngkin, who I think is very duplicitous, tried to play a game. Well, instead of ban, we'll cut it to 15 weeks with some exceptions. Democrats said, sure, this is the game he plays. And if he wins, he'll go and say, well, maybe we were a little bit too generous and we'll cut it back and have more restrictions. That was soundly rejected, and as he was. So I think abortion rights remains a very, very resonant issue.
There's an untold story in American politics, and it's a huge story. And the story is the pro-life groups have thrown in the towel. All right. So the position now of Youngkin, who saw what it's come by where Youngkin was telling people, Republicans privately that he'd sign anything that they put in front of him. So he, with the blessing of the National Pro-Life Group, says, okay, it's 15 months and then exceptions. Okay, that's
weeks,
defeat.
Right.
I mean, 15 weeks. That's defeat.
Yeah.
That's total defeat. And no one has, like, remarked that they have thrown in the towel. They said, look, you just do be for whatever you can be for. So 93, actually Paul Gall told me this, he's generally pretty factual, that 93% of the Martians occur within the first 15 weeks. Now, and he also carved out, except they're going to have an exception for the whim of the mother. We're far exception of 13 weeks, but there's an exception. It's called the whim of the mother. Okay, fine. They have lost. They have given up. They have surrendered. Now, the Virginia public saw this, and they said, bullshit. We don't trust you on this. You're just playing political games. But if you take the actual position that Youngkin took with the imprimatur of the national pro-life groups, it represents a, there's no other word for it. It's a rout. It's a surrender. They need to show up at Appomattox Courthouse with Glenn Youngkin and beg for mercy from General Grant because they beat. They're melting down like that Lee statue they melted down this week.
James, that's such a good point. You noted, I think, that Youngkin was thinking of going to Iowa after his big victories on Tuesday. I think he's more likely to go to the Isle of Wight, which is down in southeast Virginia, because it was a humiliating defeat for him. And I don't think – I think you got it a few minutes ago. He would have signed. He would have gone along with anything. They thought this was a clever compromise, which would be, as they put it, a common-sense position. People didn't agree with that, but more than that, they thought that Youngkin was duplicitous, and they'll do whatever they want to do when they get in. And it'll be a big issue in a lot of races next year. Other places, the Democrats gained a Supreme Court seat in Pennsylvania. Again, a very strong pro-choice
five
versus,
points. I mean, more than it wasn't a right razor then. And they have, you know, when these state court races, they raise money, they got organizational skill. I mean, it looks like, but Sam Alito is the father of the modern Democratic Party. I'm sorry. He just is. And is bitter and angry and rude. The old man he is. He's winning us a lot of elections, man. Clarence Thomas, he's so bought and paid for, no one gives a shit when he, you know, he's trying to scam more RVs. That story is just, these are things that have happened that we just sort of take as part of, well, somebody bought him an RV and forgave him, you know, $250,000 loan. What's the big deal? And that's just what the country has become. Immune to staggering, breathtaking corruption at the Supreme Court. But thank you, Sam.
Yeah, and you know who else was a real loser on Tuesday was Donald J. Trump. He came into Kentucky. Coleman, the attorney general, was a big McConnell guy, and McConnell embraced him as he did. And Coleman, at the end, sort of said, you know, I really want Trump rather than my old supporter Mitch, and Trump came in, made a big ad for him and everything, and it got him nothing. And also Trump was going to emulate the Glenn Youngkin abortion approach. He said it publicly. I like this kind of 15 weeks, etc. Well, you know what, Donald, that ain't going to fly either.
Do you think Trump cares anything about abortions yet? I tell you, all right, big winner.
He knows as much as he knows about the Bible, James.
Big winner in Kentucky, Fred Yang. He nailed the number Saturday, like 9 days before the election. Fred nailed. And Eric Heyer, the campaign manager, who, you know, I think the world of, I think he's a real combo told me, you know, he's got us a little north of 52. And, you know, of course, Cameron is going to close. You're not going to win. I would have thought it would have been impossible for a Democrat. Remember, Andy won by 5,000 the last time. And that was coming off the heels of 2018, which was one of the better Democratic years we've had in this century, maybe. So you can see that. And boy, there's just so much talent in this party. Please, people, wake up, look around. Smell the coffee. I mean, and the The one thing you say, you talked about President Biden, whatever, it wasn't a factor. And they ran the stuff, and it didn't do much. They ran the anti-trans stuff. They just ran the same shit playbook. And good campaigns, you know, and abortion rights are going to win almost every time.
Yeah, they are. And James, it's interesting. If you look at New Jersey and Virginia, you remember 2 years ago to this day, there was a general, really a sense of, you know, sort of a mini depression with Democrats because Phil Murphy barely hung on to win the governorship in New Jersey, and Terry McAuliffe got beaten by Youngkin. A lot different today, isn't it? I mean, Democrats gaining in New Jersey and Democrats holding on against the onslaught of the Youngkin so-called machine, which doesn't look very effective today, does it?
It doesn't, and it's all Dobbs. And by the way, Kansas, I'm sorry, led the way. Mm-hmm. All right, that thing was as big, or maybe bigger than we even thought it was.
Sure was.
You saw the same.
Well, they brought in this crack outsider to campaign for them. And with that deep Louisiana accent he had, they couldn't understand half of what he said, but they knew he was right.
That's right. You know, I get all these campaigns want me to come in. I'm sure they did it to make me feel good, but they said it was the biggest fundraiser they'd had in Kentucky political history. It was at Chrissy Brown's house, who's part of the Brown Foreman. I'm sure that had something to do with it. But at any rate, I'm going to Ohio, and I think the benefit is they can't accuse me of being a National Democrat because they can't understand what I'm saying. So I don't know if it may be so.
But I don't know. Maybe they can't, but they want more of it.
Right, right.
So,
Whatever it is,
you know, go ahead.
No, I just sent out a tweet for Senator Casey about the great night we had in Pennsylvania. I wonder what Dave McCormick, I wonder how he's scurrying around trying to figure out, because you know one thing about Dave McCormick, he don't give a fuck about abortion any more than flying the moon. All that guy cares about is he and all his billionaire friends keep as much money as they possibly can. But the Dave McCormick internal operation is trying to figure out what to say. I can't wait till he comes out.
Well, you know, that's such a good point, because they had their backup position. They thought Youngkin had really nailed it.
Yeah.
It was going to be 15 weeks. They got the most of the right-to-lifers to sell out. Trump had embraced it. And guess what? You know, the dogs don't like that dog food. It ain't gonna work.
But you're right. The abortion groups have suddenly sold out. They've surrendered. We don't want any more of this. It's stunning.
And James, you noted it started in Kansas, it did, but it's been, you know, omnipresent across the country. There was a Kentucky referendum even before this governor's race. There was a Michigan referendum. We now have Ohio. There were state races, legislative races, and New Hampshire, states as diverse as New Hampshire. And every single time, I think without exception, the pro-choice candidate or ballot initiative has won. Now, I think Republicans are going to have a nervous breakdown over this because, among other things, they have right now, as the Speaker of the House, the single highest-ranking Republican official in the land is a zealot on abortion. He would ban it totally. And I don't know how they escaped from that.
I don't either. And if anybody wants to, please Google The Daily Show, Sarah Silverman, Mike Johnson. You will laugh yourself stupid. And and every time we find out, of course, I can't understand it because I grew up around it. Every time we find out something about this guy, it's weirder and weirder. I don't care if, you know, so he doesn't have a checking account. But that, you know, it's kind of like you're making $200,000 a year. What's in his 40s, maybe late 40s? Okay, I don't know. And then he and his son, he brags that they spy on each other's computer habits. I wouldn't even go in my daughter's bedroom. I mean, is that kind of weird to
arrange? It's totally weird, James.
I mean, you know, maybe I'm God. I don't... By the way, I've heard, I would have no experience on this, be very clear, but in Louisiana, you actually can't access porn. I heard that in a bar. So if you put U-Porn in a computer, and it'll say Louisiana law, and I think they ask for a lot of information that certain people in certain positions are not willing to disclose this information. Again, I heard this. How would I know personally? But I do know that you can get it in California, where I am. It seemed to just pop right up. But so I don't know.
You were told that, Stuart. Okay.
I was told that. I would nothing, of course, that I would do myself. But right. There's something. There's a and maybe to them that's normal. But there's some. And you ever notice how much? How obsessed they are with homosexuality. I'll be honest with you. All the people that I know, talk to, over half the people I talk to, you talk to. When's the last time anybody ever brought up somebody's sexual preference? I mean, if you did, people would go, what are you talking about? It doesn't even enter our mind. All right? And that's all they talk about. I don't know. I don't know if there's any larger message out here, but it's his obsession with it is quite remarkable. And I'm like Tucker Carlson. I'm just asking questions. Why are the people why are they so obsessed with this issue? Because I'm really. Somebody gets married, we don't fucking go to the wedding, man. It's boy, girl, 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 boy, boy. We don't give a shit. I mean, polite people don't even bring this up anymore.
Right. James, let me say one thing that I hope is encouraging to your children and my children. Okay. Even if we wanted to hack into their computers, which we don't. But even if we did, we don't know how to do it. So therefore, right. I want our kids right. and my kids, oh, your kids and my kids to know. We are not going to pull a Mike Johnson.
You can hire. And by the way, on Covenant Eyes, just so you know, I'm told this. So I'm repeating something I heard, but it's probably true. But you get a $20 referral fee. So if I sign up for Covenant Eyes and I go and I get to Willow Glen Baptist Church and they get 100 of them sign up, I get a $20 cut out of every sign up. Again, it's Eric Hoffa, the smartest thing ever said in the history of the world is every movement begins as a cause, morphs into a business, and ends up a racket. It's all a fucking racket. That's all they run. The other thing before I go, just so you know, the Southern Baptist Convention said there's a law if somebody wanted to change and extend the statute of limitations for pedophilia. And the Southern Baptist Convention is very, very against that. And I just have to remind people that the Paul Pressler School of Law that Mike Johnson was going to be the dean of, there are 8 youngsters that have accused him of what I'm saying here without saying it. And that, again, there's this obsession and protection in Dennis R. Hassett. The judge said that he was a serial pedophile. But that's all I don't think about somebody. If I know somebody and I'm going to dinner, I'll ask them what the fuck if they hetero, homo, bi, who gives a shit anymore? But they do.
Yeah.
Oh boy, they're obsessed with it.
They sure do. James, I want to close this segment with just a note of personal privilege or a message to my son, Benjamin, who worked 24/7 down in Mississippi for Brandon Presley. He thought it was really important, grew to love the state, found so many people he liked who were so supportive. And Benjamin, when you're listening this week, don't be down. Even James Carville lost races before he became James Carville. So you'll be back. You had the better candidate. You ran the better campaign. It's just the odds were stacked against you.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's the whole thing. It's Uncle Lloyd, the best time to get back on a horse is right after you've been thrown. I mean, that's one of, you know, my life's lesson from my uncle taught me that. So, no, he better than have anything. They, you know, he really, people really loved him down there, and his career's, you know, he's getting started here. And that was a tough place.
Well, they outraised the incumbent governor, which nobody would have predicted.
But nobody.
Right, right.
And did it honestly.
So anyway, Ben, this is just the start. Hey, James, we have today one of the great journalists in America, Thomas Byrne Edsel, who anything he writes, I devour because it's so thoughtful, and he just rises above the perfunctory with every single piece. Tom, first of all, welcome. And you wrote a brilliant piece in the New York Times on the political ascent of white Christian nationalists. One of its own, Mike Johnson, is now Speaker of the House, who was called the embodiment of white Christian nationalism. How does their agenda, priorities differ from other political conservatives?
Well, primarily they believe that the United States, one, is a Christian nation, and that the pursuit of biblical truth should be basically incorporated into the goal and function of government. That government should be basically an agent of Christianity. To some extent, there are tones of meaning white Christianity, but they don't usually say that explicitly. The other quite big point is they don't really trust democracy. Mike Johnson has said democracy is like two wolves and a lamb. And basically, they believe that the elected leadership should be a Christian supporting entity, and that voters should pick people like that. How all that works in a democracy is a little difficult to figure out.
Well, Tom, also their history is a little bit hard to figure out. They claim we are a Christian nation since the founding. And that Thomas Jefferson's famous letter to the Danbury Baptists said unequivocally, there is a wall of separation between church and state. How do they address that, or do they just ignore that?
Well, basically, they ignore that. And also, I mean, Jefferson's comment is an assertion of his view. It's not institutionalized in the Constitution, per se, so that they can challenge it in the sense that it's not law as such. They have a different interpretation of what government should be and the goals that it should pursue. This is part of a larger phenomenon taking place on the right. You see guys like Patrick Deneen at Notre Dame pushing basically a very similar argument from a Catholic point of view. And there's an increasing agreement on, and the Claremont Institute, for example, you wouldn't call it a white Christian nationalist institute, but it does support policies and viewpoints that are very similar, where they see the political system as the last refuge of the good and decent people of America. And go ahead.
No, I think that's fascinating. You know, as I recall my American history, Mr. Jefferson played a little bit of a role in drafting not only the Declaration, but also the Constitution. And he wrote that letter to the Danbury Baptists when he was president of the United States. But I guess if you hold a worldview that you don't want to have questioned, it's just easier to dismiss it. The other thing that Mike Johnson said is the Bible is the word. Everything he does Johnson said in an interview, is drawn from the Bible. Now, Tom, I'm going to admit it's been a while since I've read the good book, but help me. I don't recall any passages that called for denying a perfectly legitimate election or waging a false impeachment. And even on immigration, which they are very anti, there's the story of the Good Samaritan. So is it my biblical ignorance or is it Mike Johnson's?
I think the Bible lends itself to so many different interpretations, and there are different elements of the scripture that can be, it's like statistics. I don't want to say something, but once you get them down, they'll do anything for you. The Bible is really, it's what people read into it rather than what's in it. And you can make counter arguments all over the place. Once you get into that kind of discussion, you're going to lose because it is such a everything is a back and forth. I believe this. There's this citation in the Bible. If you look at this place, it doesn't agree with that. I mean, I could go on and on, but I'm not a biblical expert either.
Tom, one more question, then turn it over to James. White Christian nationalists are a huge force in the Republican Party. Are they as bigger than big business or neocons or any other Republican-supporting interest group?
I think they've certainly edged out big business, although big business is not out of the ballgame. But in terms of politics, the whole Trump election was a realignment within the Republican Party of who has power. He empowered clearly white, non-college voters, basic working-class whites, and he gave them power to pick nominees. It used to be the big business, the lobbyists downtown, the establishment Republicans consistently picked the Republican nominee. Trump violated that whole principle that had been going on for decades and basically created an insurgency within the party. In doing so, he empowered not just white non-college guys, but the whole white Christian movement. And it is the most active movement on the right and represents roughly 40% of the Republican electorate. That is enough to elect or defeat almost anybody within the Republican Party electorate. So it has a huge degree of leverage there. It's also very conscious of what its goals are and who it wants to elect. The steady elimination of moderate Republicans and the rise of conservative, hard-nosed, hard-right Republicans has come in large part from the districts that are disproportionately evangelical. And so you see a real rising sense of power and strength on the religious right within the Republican Party. As a part of the national situation, white Christians are a declining population. But they turn out in droves. Even as they have declined, their share of the electorate has stayed the same. They've been able to sustain more and better turnout over time than almost any other group you could name. And it's finally paying off for them within Republican Party ranks. And you see it now with the election of Mike Johnson.
James Carville.
Just a comment along those lines. There's a famous letter, I think, from George Washington to the sexton of the Jewish congregation in Rhode Island. But he was pretty clear. I think he was a chairman of the Constitutional Convention, minor figure in early American
history. That's
what's
Jefferson,
Yeah. So we'll gloss over that and what his feelings were. if I read your column and I was in college and somebody said, describe what Tom Etzel is talking about, I'd say, well, he's talking about a theocracy. That's what they really want.
I think that's right, actually. They want government tied to a religion or to a set of religious beliefs, and that is a theocracy. Right. You're right.
And if you want to know what it really is, look at the Syllabus of Errors. It was issued by the Roman Catholic Church, I think, in the 1870s. Just please look it up and see how profoundly fucking stupid it is. But let me go to David Broder. To me, is one of the more comical figures in American political journalism. But and he was very much, but on the other hand. And this is, and this Broderism exists today. All right, James, they got their crazies. All right, I'll admit that. But you got to admit the Democratic Party has its crazies. So compare the strength of what I call, to be polite, the identity left. What I'm talking about is the Amherst Humanities faculty and people that go around policing language and et cetera, et cetera. They're influence on the Democratic Party and the theocrats' influence on the Republican Party, I suspect that they're not remotely the same.
They're not. I mean, it's clear that the what you call the theocrats are much more influential and, in fact, can exercise veto power over whatever policy, especially in the House, is going to be adopted. And in terms of their actual votes, they are the plurality group within the Republican Party. The left wing of the Democratic Party is basically a small faction and has much less power. But the problem is it gets a great deal of attention. And when they do things like call for defunding the police or voting against Israel on a House resolution, it gets much more attention than the right wing of the Republican Party has gotten a fair amount of attention with this whole McCarthy speakership fight. Right. It's brought to light a lot.
So the people that we know, a lot of them we like, foster this kind of crap. And they love to say, well, yeah, they're crazy, but, you know, splinter in your eye, whatever analogy they draw. And I think this both-siderism, this equivalency, I think it's an insidious, dangerous force in American journalism. And I think when people do that, they ought to be called out because it's just a stupid throwaway line that in no way comports with the reality of the influence of these two groups within the party.
I agree, but how are you going to, when you say they ought to be called out, you're referring really to media people?
Yeah. Yeah. When somebody writes something that stupid, they need to be called on the phone. And people have enormous respect for you, and they're not evil. They're just repeating the same shit, vacuous, vapid crap that you hear all of the time. And no one wants to call it on it. I mean, if I go out, I can imagine how many speeches I give, and it's all, well, yeah, they're crazy. But it's not the same. It just isn't. To establish a theocracy. To call democracy, I don't know, two wolves and whatever he calls it, it's so creeped into our culture and to the way that we think, and I think it's, not only is it wrong, it's dangerous because it equates naivety with, say, evil, but I think a theocracy... Theocracy is an evil form of government. Go try Iran if you think it's good. Go live there. There's a theocracy in motion. And I don't think that AOC or any of these people, I think they're naive, but they're not bad people. These people are nuts. And thank you for, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate a guy like you writing a piece like this, drawing attention to it, And the other crazy part of this, I'm talking a little too much, but is this whole young Earth. And understand, the two things they believe, the Earth is 6,000 years old and they really believe in fossil fuels. Wait a minute. How do you think that shit got here? Oh, no. And Mike Johnson is not just a guy that says he's funny. You know, George W. Bush said, well, you know, some people say it. I have an open mind. It's not an open mind. Earth ain't 6,000 years old. Fuck it. No, it's not. Not even close. It's not even 600,000 years old. It's not even 6 million years old. All right? But we just let it go. And, you know, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate the fact you put this in print and you put it with a guy. Your reputation and your stature in a place that I still think has too much vapid nonsense, the New York Times, but this was good. Thank you for what you did. It's a great piece.
I appreciate that. But you raise a question that is, it's been the constant problem for Trump has turned what has been a long-term problem into a major problem. And it's one that the media, the press, whatever, has been unable to find any kind of effective solution.
So before I let you go, Tom, I'll turn back to Aldous. I suspect that you, like me, think that Rui Teixeira and John B. Judas are kind of smart, observant people. Why do they keep telling us how bad the Democratic Party is and we keep winning fucking elections? If the Democratic Party is falling apart and is subject to, we've lost everybody on immigration, we've lost everybody on police, we lost everybody on everything, but the only thing we don't lose is elections.
And on top of that, you said that this Time Siena poll makes Biden look like a walking liability, and then they win elections. I agree. Yeah. There's something weird going on.
There is. Well, tell John and Rui that I just want to know if we losing everything, why do we keep winning?
But John and Rui, they emphasize the liabilities of the Democratic Party, which both of you guys have done at times. You with the faculty lounge cracks, and I think both of you have found the problems of the Democratic left causing problems for the whole Democratic Party. But in terms of the seriousness, which is where the rubber really hits the road, there is no comparison.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Trump. These white Christian nationalists are profess to be deeply religious people. So how do they justify their support for Trump, who a judge has found committed rape? He was caught on camera making despicably crude remarks about women. He's ridiculed people with disabilities. Pete Wehner, who is a devout Christian, has said Trump is a man more identified with hedonism than Christianity. So how do those people that you were writing about this week, how do they justify Trump?
It's even more dramatic than that. Everything that Trump does, Mike Johnson has cited as behavior that has led to the downfall and the undermining of civilized America. When you get into the specifics of the morality that Trump violates, he sees that as a cause of decline in America, but he does not make the linkage between Trump, who he has endorsed, and Trump embodying the behavior and the morality that he believes is at the heart of the collapse of American civilization. He doesn't make that linkage. And instead, I've only seen one comment from him on this. He was asked in a Louisiana radio station interview about this, and I wish I had it in front of me, but he had basically a mealy-mouthed answer saying, I know he's had his problems, but with facing Joe Biden, we have to make a choice, and it's in this case, and we have to stand by the man who is closer to us. But it's all the it's a political excuse, and there has been no rationale that works that fits Christians and Trump in the same room together, much less in the same party together.
Well, Tom, one might, which you wrote about, you had one of your respondents talked about Christo-fascism.
Was that Mike Podozer, I think?
No, I don't think it was, but I can't, you know, I should have your article in front of me.
I think that there's a lot to that, this idea of, if you want to impose a theocracy, it's going to have to be done in an authoritarian fashion. That means basically skirting democracy and avoiding democratic procedures. So that end run to achieve the goal that they want to, and this is true also of the Patrick Deneen kind of argument on the Catholic right, it requires an effort to basically overcome what has become an increasingly liberal electorate. America has moved left consistently over time for the past 50 years. There's a very good article about this that I was just reading, where the trend line is just steadily moving to the left. The Christian right and its allies are getting left behind. They are fighting.
Where was that article, Tom?
Huh?
You remember? Where was that article?
I'll send it to you. But
good. Okay.
They have been left behind, and they talk about themselves as the left behind. And when you're when you're in a battle and you're losing, and you see the other side has more troops than you, and it's a democracy, you decide you better not fight just by democratic means. You have to use other tactics, i.e., you have to screw up elections as much as you can. You have to deny people the right to vote whenever you can. You have to make it so that only your people can do the choosing. You have to divide gerrymandered districts in a fashion that will work for you. All these are rear guard actions to deny an emerging majority, which is much more left than these guys want, and they see it as a threat to their very existence. And when you're on the ropes like that, you're willing to play dirty. And it's a characteristic of a defensive position that when you see the other side is having more ammunition than you, you got to figure out some way to subvert them. And that means using many dirty tricks as you can.
Yeah, I would notice that probably their two top issues, or two of their three or four top issues, are abortion and gay rights, and it's just been steadily moving against their interest in that. So I think that's a illustration of the point you're making. James Carville, you want to wrap this up with a great Thomas Burnessel?
Right. I do think that Tom has, and I said it earlier, and I'm being repetitive here, but I think it's worth repeating, is pointing out something that people don't realize. They look at him, and these people tend to be relentlessly nice or polite. That's what people say about it. I'm sure that's the way he is. What this guy believes is insidious. It's a real, real danger. I mean, they're coming after this, and, you know, they don't give up. They don't quit. We go off, and, you know, we get distracted. And the stuff that you're writing about is just... It's so against our traditions, you know, and I'll leave a point now. You can comment as you please. Gary Wills, who I think knows what he's talking about, points out that the most secular generation of leaders that the United States has ever had are the founding fathers. All right? They were all children of the Enlightenment. They were not a particularly, they talked about nature's God and deity and that kind of stuff, but you weren't likely to catch George Washington in a church very often, I don't think. And they have taken this and misrepresented it and put it out there with grievances like, look, I'm a 79-year-old white, no doubt about that. I was a cradle Catholic. I'm straight and I'm a male and I've never been discriminated against. I look back on my 79 years and say, what are the things that you don't remember? Black people where I grew up were 80%, 85%. They were really discriminated against. Gay people were really discriminated against. But yet these people have all convinced each other that they're under siege from what? I don't know.
There is a real victimhood mentality that has taken place. And I think it's basically because they're losing the game. And they've basically externalized and blamed others for what is their loss and their inability to maintain support for the views that they have that are really, as you point out, are decaying and falling aside. But this victimhood thing is really that's another whole matter. It's become endemic. Everyone said that Democrats are too focused on being victims. But the fact is, Trump has turned the Republican Party into a victimhood party. And in doing so, he has really tapped into something on the right, but he's turned the party into, in effect, a much more vengeful party, determined to fight this victimhood position with the tactics of a pro wrestler.
Everybody out there ought to read Tom's piece last week in the New York Times about white Christian nationalists. It'll scare you a little bit, but boy, you'll learn a lot. Tom, you're always one of our very favorite guests, so thank you so much.
It's good to be here with you guys.
All right, James, now for the outrages of the week. Look, the Israeli-Gaza war is brutal, with emotions raw on both sides. Israel's usually contentious citizenry is united in supporting the eradication of the Hamas terrorist who on October 7th killed innocent civilians and children. The Arab streets are pulsating with a fury over the Israeli response, which is also killing lots of innocent citizens and children in Gaza. Now, President Biden, while fully supporting Israel, is trying to temper the bloodshed, urging, so far with little success, and cajoling the Israelis to scale back these military plans, to think more of the humanitarian effect. No surprise, this has drawn criticism. But Rashida Tlaib, a Palestinian-American representing Michigan in the U.S. House, went beyond any reasonable bounds. The Michigan Democrat accused Biden of supporting, quote, genocide of the Palestinian people and vowed not to forget in 2024. Now, that's a lie, and I wonder how pleased the Congresswoman would be in 2025 if Donald Trump is elected. And we now...
go ahead. So let me finish this. I don't much care for her. I don't have a lot in common with her, but, you know, she represents the district. I certainly don't agree with her views, but I don't know if censure is such a good idea.
Totally agree.
I don't really care much about her. I'm sure she don't care much about me. I wish she would get the label of a socialist as opposed, you know, so she wouldn't walk around with Democrat after her name, but
censures.
And probably a popular view in her district. I don't know. As you know, and listeners to this program know, and I've been very big on this Tuberville and this idiotic, and by the way, They keep losing election abortions, and they keep denying promotions based on Tuberville's whatever, you know, archaic view of abortion. But the best thing I've read on it is by my friend Sidney Blumenthal. It's in The Guardian. And the conclusion, I think, is the correct one. The man is just stupid. He's just a moron. You don't need to go much deeper than that. What do they call Occam's razor? You're supposed to mumble at it if you're smart. The simplest explanation is the best one. Yeah, he's dumb. He's really dumb. And the stupidity runs so deep in that political party. Maybe he's smarter than James Comer, but not. No, he's not. No, he's dumber than Comer. Comer's maybe slightly smarter than him. And Comer keeps calling witnesses that tell him he's full of shit. And he keeps doing it. Don't stop these investigations, Comer. Keep calling people. Keep it out.
Amen. I think that's
But read Sidney's piece in The Guardian.
Sid Blumenthal in The Guardian. You know, Comer-Tuberville IQ runoff, it would be a contest worth watching.
Yeah, all right. I'll ask ACL to give me some odds and make book on that. How we can test them, I don't know. But it hovers somewhere around room temperature.
That's on a cool day.
It's room temperature, I think, is 60 to 70 Fahrenheit, like 20 centigrade. IQ might be on the Fahrenheit scale.
And now for a segment we love, the fabulous questions we get from our listeners. James, there's a whole bunch of Biden age questions. I'm going to just shorthand them and you can combine them in your answer. Brendan Nashville says, would you guys quit griping about Biden's age and reframe the issue? It's about democracy, stupid. And Matthew in Silver Spring, Maryland, on the other hand, asks, could the party elders step in and convince Biden that stepping down is best? And then our friend John in Sonoma, California, says Biden is good at one job, being president, and very bad at another important job, campaigning for president. Isn't the time now? Stop waiting for permission. What should he be doing now? James, take him over.
Well, you know, I think that this is something that voters are really taking into account. There's no doubt this is hurting us. And so I've said it. I've been saying it for a long time. It's been pretty consistent. So look, the rebut to that, you're not being real, okay? You're a bedwetter. And what's going to happen, and I see this all the time, I see Jennifer Rubin, even Rachel Maddow, and smart people say, this is what's going to happen. It's going to be Biden. It's going to be Trump. Everything else is frivolous. And then it's going to be a choice between Biden and Trump. And Trump is so revulsive that Biden will be, and this according to Biden, says, I'm the alternative. So we will elect the alternative. Now, this is what I call political Calvinism or predestination, that everything in politics is going to happen. We already know in advance what's going to happen. And what we don't need is a bunch of whiny people. And of course, in this world, there are no heart attacks and no strokes and no memory lapses and no plea deals. There's no convictions. There's no quirky New Hampshire. There's nothing. There's only political certainty. And I just got to tell you, I don't believe in political Calvinism. I don't think it's all been, the result is all preordained and the events of a campaign have all been decided in advance. But a lot of smart people disagree with me. So I'll continue to note that the public by three quarters wants another choice. And I love President Biden. I think he's a state school guy. I think he's got a record that
none of us could think he'd do, but I don't think this is a good choice. I really don't.
Yeah, I'm afraid I agree with you. Ohio voters, it was a Democratic-tilted electorate because of the abortion issue, and they, by 59-39, they gave Biden a negative grade, and I think a lot of that has to do with concerns about his age. James, our next question is from Drew in Oxford, Mississippi. I was just in Oxford last week. What a fabulous town. And
yeah, we didn't do worth a shit in Lafayette County either.
I know, but it's still a great town with one of the best bookstores in America. Hey, and Drew asks, what's your first impression of Dean Phillips? To me, he seems authentic and has a positive, respectful message, looks sharp, energetic, and has good hair, too, Drew says. You've spoken about Biden. James, you can ignore that part. You've spoken about Biden.
Spoke about what?
You can ignore the part about that Phillips has good hair, too. You've spoken about Biden's team, lack of effective messaging. What chances do you give Phillips for a successful primary campaign? Drew, if you're talking about the nomination, none. But I do think he can make a big difference in New Hampshire. And we'll see if that has the Biden people reconsidering. You got to give him courage for running because a lot of people would like to challenge Biden, but just are too timid to do that. Or they buy into this fact that he's the eventual nominee no matter what, and all they'll do is split the party. But he's not going to be the nominee, but he could play an important role early on.
Well, so I don't know him. I've talked to him on the phone. He's called me. I've talked to him once, I think. Watch him on Bill Maher. Watch Dean Phillips on Bill Maher. And this guy has got a lot more talent than anybody imagines. He's made a couple of, I call them, gaffes. So somebody, he said he started complaining about the DNC. Fuck the DNC. No one cares about that. That's not your argument. But he adjusts quickly. I thought he was superb on Bill Maher. And he is like, I wish other people would run. The guy just, he's making total sense. And just watch that clip. It's like 5 minutes. It's one-on-one. It's not the easiest interview in the world. And I thought he was really good.
I agree. Let's watch it. And forget Gene McCarthy in 1968.
And by the way, he's Dear Abby's grandson.
Well, Minnesota Challengers have an interesting track record.
Right.
Ian in Ohio. Now, Ian, next time you got to tell us where in Ohio. It's a big state. Says poll numbers show Biden losing Gen Z voters and minority voters in droves. How can he win them back?
It's above my pay grade, dude. I have to say, it's so bad. He's like winning by one with under 30 or something. I mean, it's horrific. The black turnout is horrific, and of course the political Calvinists, the predestination crowd. Oh, don't worry, it's all going to come back in the end. These people have no idea of what you have to do to win an election. They have no idea of if one share of the vote goes down that's favorable to you, it's almost certain that another share of the vote that is unfavorable to you is going to go up. But I can't fight political Calvinism because it knows everything. Everything is preordained. You're just a bedwetter or a warrior or whatever. And it's the whole fucking thing is so fucking ridiculous that these people, we're going to get 90, we're going to get 63% of the under 30. Well, I'm not too sure, but as opposed to getting 63% of 17, you might get 63% of 15, which ain't good, and they're going to get more older whites showing up, which is not going to be good for you. That whole thing is stupid. I'm sorry.
Tell us how you really feel, James.
Second it, by the way. Chip in Milford, Kansas, says, with election polling failing miserably in the last couple election cycles, how much should we trust the new polls? They show Trump leading Biden in 5 or 6 states. Maybe there's just a problem with polling methodology. Chip, I think most polls have been pretty good. There was a sense that among Democrats that the Mississippi polls were off. But as James noted earlier, Fred Yang did a fabulous job in Kentucky, calling it almost exactly. There wasn't, I think, the polls in Ohio were right on. There are good polls and bad polls. I thought that Siena poll had some flaws, but directionally it seemed right on the mark. So, Chip, I'm a little bit higher on polls than you are.
The polls in Mississippi, the internal polls, I mean, there's a certain exactitude that you just can't expect about it, but they had Reeves in a 1-point lead. Obviously, we didn't get the turnout we thought. Maybe it breaks a bit, but I think polling has been pretty good. You can go through any poll and find something about it that you don't like. And sometimes it's just the nature of random sampling, you know, where you don't do one demographic is different. But by and large, and by the way, when you look at the sample, and that's 3,600 interviews. Understand what that was. That was 6 interviews, 600 in 6 states. And when you look internally, and that's what you do, do you realize that by more than just a little bit, there are more Biden voters who would consider voting for Trump than there are Trump voters that would consider voting for Biden? Digest that.
Yeah, That's
really, in 3,600 interviews, that's a lot. The margin of error is not very much.
I agree.
Not very much.
We're hearing from the UK today. Tom over in London asked, good question, will Steve Bannon pay a political or legal price for trying to destroy America?
Why is that guy not in jail?
He's been sentenced, hasn't he?
I don't really understand. The other thing is, why can't that? I'm gonna get a lawyer and see if I can sue that son of a bitch for copyright infringement or something. But he calls his show The War Room. You can't think of the name of your. You can't think of an original name that you come up with. All right? I mean, at least our show has some pedigree, some connection. But I don't know how that, by the way, and if he does go to jail, how'd you like to be in the same cell with him? Oh, you think that son of a bitch don't stink?
I hope they have showers there.
Yeah, there's something. They ought to fumigate him before he goes in there. He's a menace to the other inmates and guards.
Douglas in Chicago, Illinois, says, wondering if there are any second thoughts about the House Democrats in not saving Kevin McCarthy's speakership or even going with Tom Emmer, a more moderate conservative. The answer to that, Douglas, is no, because whatever they had done, a McCarthy or an Emmer would be beholden to that right wing. And if they got too cozy with the Democrats, even in a little way, even in a responsible way, that had been a move to unseat them right away. So it just, I'm sorry. The problem is not the Democrats' failure to support a McCarthy or Emmer. It's the total right failure of the right wing Republican caucus.
Well, the ghost of David Broder lives on. You hear these commentators, these chin scratchers. The Democrats have a responsibility. They should have done X, Y, Z. Well, okay, what Republican came up and voted when we had a 4-vote majority? And secondly, they can't do that because they would lose the election. I mean, if it ever came to that point, and, politics today has come to a strange place, that would be so historic that it would be breathtaking. I don't know how it could possibly work without a lot more pain on their part. And the pain was so great that, what I want to know is, what happened to the 18 that were in this? They were going to be, the Tom Kane's kid and Bacon from Nebraska, and they were going to be responsible. There was yeah, the majority of that caucus was Marjorie Taylor Greene and Warren Boat, whatever. What about them? Why didn't they step up? Why do we say, why didn't Hakeem Jeffers step up? Why didn't they, the 18 or the 20, is it? It was two that Biden lost by 1%. And we always have faith that these sound good, principled conservatives really going to do what's right by the country. They not.
Well,
quit waiting.
You're right. Of the timid 20, which I like to call them, they voted, the majority voted for Jim Jordan. And they all voted for Mike Johnson. I want to see how how they defend that that vote next year. James, our final question is from Craig in Minneapolis, whose 16-year-old daughter asked, who decided the voting age should be 18? We found the story of the 26th Amendment. Interestingly, the whole process appears to have taken only 4 months, which brings my question. Why not an amendment to set the age for president at 35 to 75?
Well, I think the public's going to have to do that. Passing a constitutional amendment is not like going to the drugstore. It's with the 2/3 of Congress, 3/4 of the states. I mean, that's great. And I'm glad this young person is thinking about that. I think we need more young people that do that. And when you go through the journey and, you know, do – I was listening to Bob Rubin, you know, who has a new book called – the yellow legal pad, and he's obviously a guy who's made a lot more good decisions than bad decisions in his life. And, you know, you should, and I congratulate you for thinking this. I think it's highly unlikely to happen, but as long as we got young people like you are thinking about this and bringing it up, that's a very good thing. Congratulations to this young woman, or young girl.
I totally.
When does a girl become a woman? I'm always like, is it 18 or? I don't know. I'm so scared I'm going to call somebody the wrong thing.
I'm just very cautious, James. That's the best way to be on that.
It's the best way to be.
I'm also cautious in seeing someone I haven't seen in a while, and it looks like they've gained weight. And I never want to say, because I made this mistake about 20 years ago, I never want to ask them when they're expecting, because they weren't expecting then, and it was really, really bad for me.
This is some comedian says, if your wife asks, he says, does my ass look big in this? That only answer you give is ass. I don't know. Do you have an ass? I never noticed. don't comment. I'm just giving you a little tip out there for those of you who don't know. Never talk about a woman's ass. That ain't good. You'll get in trouble.
All right. I want you to keep those questions coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, send them in again next week because we'll sure try to get to them. They are terrific. It was good to have some people from across the pond this week. But send them in again to us. And don't forget, tell us where you're from. Not just Ohio, but where in Ohio. Thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, Miracle Brand, Real Paper, and ZBiotics, in the episode show notes. We deeply thank you for supporting them. When you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel, or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast site. Remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.